You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up on a hot August day, spending a day lakeside with friends and family sounds pretty good. We talked to the author of a new memoir who's had the chance to spend many summer days lakeside about the Wisconsin cottage experience. First, we now know what the November ballot looks like for Wisconsin. We know who will be running for governor, U.S. Senate, Congress, the state legislature, and other offices. In yesterday's elections, state superintendent of public instruction Tony Evers emerged the winner of the Democratic primary for governor. He'll take on Governor Scott Walker, who easily won his Republican primary. In the nation's most expensive Senate primary, Republican State Senator Leah Vukmir defeated Marine veteran Kevin Nicholson. She'll face Democratic incumbent U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin. In the state's most closely watched congressional race, iron worker Randy Bryce won the Democratic primary in southern Wisconsin's 1st District. He'll go up against attorney and UW Regent Brian Stile, who took the GOP primary. The winner of that race in November will succeed House Speaker Paul Ryan, who is not seeking re-election. In other election news, two state lawmakers lost their primary bids. Madison will have its first African-American member of the state assembly, and voter turnout was the highest in years. Lily Gorin is a professor of political science at Carroll University. She's an expert in American politics, Congress, and public policy. She's also the author of Mad Men and Politics, Nostalgia and the Remaking of Modern America. Lily, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me today.
Well, let's begin with the race for governor. Voters had their choice of 10 Democrats, two dropped out before the actual election, and 42% of the voters on that side went with Tony Evers. Coming in second was firefighter union head Malin Mitchell. He was second with 16%, and former state representative Kelda Royce was third with 13%. How do you think Evers was able to come out with as much of a cushion as he did?
Well, I think, you know, Tony Evers had won statewide races before, and so people knew who he was a little bit more than some of the other candidates. A lot of the other candidates who were running in the Democratic primary had a lot of support in their particular home bases, but were not necessarily as well known as Evers across the state. So I think that's probably a large part of what contributed to his cushion, as you say.
There was a comment on Facebook from Rick. He wrote, "The self-proclaimed party of diversity and social justice once again picks an old white guy to run for governor. This one may have even less appeal than Tom Barrett, which is quite a feat." Do you think that Rick is tapping into a general feeling, or is Evers going to get voters excited?
That obviously remains to be seen in the general election. He is a white guy, and he's running against another white guy. But, you know, if we can segue slightly into probably the next topic, we have two women running for the U.S. Senate seat, which I think is the first time we've seen a statewide race between two women in Wisconsin.
And we'll definitely talk about that race. First, I want to stay at the top of the ticket there. Former State Representative Mandela Barnes won the Democratic primary for lieutenant governor. So he and Evers will be combined as one ticket on the November ballot. Barnes is African-American. So going back to Rick's comment about maybe Evers not really breaking the mold, does at least having Mandela Barnes on the ticket make the Democratic side maybe a little more appealing, maybe a little more exciting?
Well, it's certainly, again, you know, you sort of seeing more and more African-Americans running in a variety of places. And we saw this in some of the assembly races as well that you highlighted in the overview. And at the same time, you have Scott Walker, who is likely, again, to continue with Rebecca Clayfish. So you do have a little bit of diversity in both those tickets.
What do you think, Lily, having watched a lot of elections, do you think that the vast majority of state Democrats, even if they were not behind Evers for the primary, obviously with eight candidates still on the ballot by the time or still in the race by the time people were voting, it was split amongst a lot of different candidates. Do you think that that other, say, 68% or so of people who voted for someone else will get in line behind Evers?
Well, as we've seen over the years, with regard to the Scott Walker administration, a lot of Wisconsin Democrats are not enthusiastic and, you know, obviously some years back also advocated for and pushed through a recall. So I have a feeling that a lot of the Wisconsin Democrats who in the past have not been great fans of the Walker administration are likely to coalesce around Evers and Barnes as they, you know, as they battle with Walker.
So shortly after the race was called for Evers, the state Republican Party launched a digital and TV ad that attacked Evers. It talked about a Middleton teacher who kept his license in 2014 despite having viewed pornographic images at work and showing them to his female coworkers. Evers said this morning in Madison that he didn't have the power to revoke the teacher's license because students didn't actually see the material. Here's what Evers had to say.
We did that revocation by state law, and we changed state law that so it fixed that loophole. Simple as that. I was following state law as a constitutional officer. That's what the people of Wisconsin expected of me as state superintendent. And so these type of attack ads are ridiculous, but we should expect that he's going to go on and on about this. This is going to be carpet bombing.
And then Governor Walker was on a tour around the state today, and this is what he had to say about Evers' position during a stop in Eau Claire.
This is one of those where I believe that the answer that he didn't think he could do it is a bureaucratic answer. True leadership stands up and says, I'm going to stand up and defend children. He failed to do that. I think that's an important difference.
Do you think this specific case about this Middleton teacher is going to stay an issue in this race?
I mean, it may, but I have a feeling that this race is going to have a lot of different ads and different sort of policy points and different attack points. So this may be one that the opposition, the Walker team, puts forward and you know, attempts to try to define Evers by. But I have a feeling there are probably going to be more on both sides.
We're talking with Lily Gorin. She's a professor of political science at Carroll University, and we're taking a look at the election results from yesterday's primary here in Wisconsin. And Governor Walker also released his first ad of the general election cycle. Guess we're not getting any kind of breathing room after
nope.
the primaries,
nope.
saying he would forgive up to $5,000 in student loan debt for those who stay in Wisconsin and work in high demand jobs. He also promised tax breaks to parents who pay for childcare and senior citizens who stay in their homes. He didn't mention what the price tag would be for those or whether he would have support in the legislature to pass it. What's your read on these kind of, you know, very big idealistic proposals?
Well, you know, again, Scott Walker is not an outsider at this point, and it's one of the points that I've made, you know, to some degree of late. He came in kind of as an outsider and an advocate for a different way of doing business and doing politics, and we've seen that, you know, during his time in office. But this is his third campaign for the governor's office, not including the recall, and he has, you know, he has a record that people either support or may attack. And so he may be trying to also sort of push forward of this is what I'm going to do next, at the same time that there are a lot of people who are asking about, you know, some of the transportation issues and the results of the Foxconn deal and so forth.
The Walker campaign has challenged Tony Evers to two debates. That's the same number of debates that he agreed to in 2014 against then-candidate Mary Burke. Tony Evers said today that he'd like to debate Walker every night. How important are debates in general, and do you see them being important in this particular race?
Well, I have a feeling we're going to see a lot of advertising in a lot of venues. So on our televisions, on the radio, when you go online in terms of seeing advertisements there as well. So debates allow at least for the individual voter to see a little bit more of the candidates back and forth and how they think on their feet, as opposed to, you know, what is essentially prepackaged either attack ads ads or supportive ads. And I have a feeling that's oftentimes when people do tune into debates, that's what they want to see. They want to see the candidates engaging in, to some degree, longer discussions and conversations.
And before we move on to the Senate race, you talked about a lot of advertising. Of course, advertising takes a lot of money.
Yep.
Governor Walker had a war chest during the primaries. It was probably the end of June reporting, where was, I believe, $5.8 million, definitely more than $5 million. Tony Evers was not even the highest fundraiser of the Democratic candidates in the primary. How is the money going to stack up?
Well, you know, this remains to be seen, and because there's likely to also be outside money that comes into the state. In the past, we've seen a lot of outside money come into this state with regard to some of these statewide races. You know, how much money ultimately is spent both at the governor's, on the governor's race, and also on the Senate race, it's probably going to be quite a lot.
We're talking with Carroll University political scientist Lily Gorin about yesterday's primary elections and what's on tap for November. And we want to hear what's on your mind at 800-642-1234. Who are you backing for governor, for U.S. Senate, for Congress? How excited are you about your choices for November? Are you seeing a blue wave coming this fall in Wisconsin? Or do you think Republicans will fend off those challenges and maybe even pick up seats? How are you feeling this day after the primary? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We pick up our conversation now about yesterday's primary elections with Lily Gorin. She's a professor of political science at Carroll University. And you can weigh in at 800-642-1234. How are you feeling about yesterday's elections? Did your candidates win or lose? How excited are you about the November ballot? Are you pulling for Tony Evers or Governor Walker or maybe one of the third party candidates? And what about the contest between Leah Vukmir and Tammy Baldwin? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Lily, let's move on to that U.S. Senate race. State Senator Leah Vukmir beat Marine veteran Kevin Nicholson 49-43%. Is that what you expected for how that race would play out?
I didn't think that Vukmir would have all that much of a problem in the primary. And those numbers sort of reflect the fact that I thought that she would probably win the nomination.
And she had the backing of the Republican establishment, and she got the nomination of the state GOP. Should that have been a bigger margin that she won by, given that?
No, I mean, she did a lot of campaigning, and she went all over the state, a lot of retail campaigning. She does have a lot of fans and supporters within the Wisconsin GOP, and she did have a lot of, you know, endorsements across the board. But Nicholson had a lot of money backing him, a lot more money, I believe, than she did. And that probably was one of the assets that he did have that pushed his numbers as high as they did in terms of his capacity to advertise and get himself a bit better known than he had been.
Do you think that the Nicholson supporters will get behind Vukmir in the fall?
I would assume that quite a few of them probably will. I mean, I think this will be a hotly contested Senate race. I think that there'll be a lot of national attention on it as well as statewide attention on it. I expect to see Walker and Vukmir campaigning together. I also expect to see probably Baldwin and Evers campaigning together. And I expect that we shall probably see quite a few supporters, surrogates, national level surrogates coming into the state as well.
So Leah Vukmir will go up against the incumbent Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin. She said America needs another conservative in Washington. She also said during her victory speech last night that people will be hearing the following message throughout the campaign.
Tammy Baldwin let you down at the Tomah VA.
Yeah.
Tammy Baldwin ignored a whistleblower report that told her and only her that a doctor was overprescribing opioids and a veteran died.
Yeah.
And many others became addicted. I will not let her forget that. And I want you to know, veterans in this room and active duty, I have your back. I will never let you down.
So Lilly, Democrats have said Baldwin has worked with the parents of the vet who died and that she's called for three separate investigations into the facility. How much has the Thoma story stuck to Baldwin, and is this going to be a big hurdle for her in getting past the November election?
It has stuck to her. And so when it happened, there was definitely a partisan attempt to, you know, have this as a defining story about Baldwin. And, you know, Baldwin is a first term senator, so she wasn't as well known statewide as other people who have run for statewide offices more. And so this is part of, you know, what she has, you know, she's been sort of labeled with. And I think it's also one of the things she's been campaigning against, if you will, as she's trying to move people to support her. And she has been doing a lot of campaigning in the state, even though she didn't really have much of a threat during the primaries. But she's been trying to, you know, get around the state, you know, talk to people, again, sort of this retail politics, and her numbers have been inching up for her probably as a result of some of that.
We have some callers who want to weigh in on the governor's race. Let's go to Jeremy in Middleton. Hi, Jeremy.
Yes, hi. I was just calling because I've returned back to Wisconsin after living the last 3 years over in Honolulu. I can tell you that Governor Ige in Hawaii is so inspirational compared to the governor that we have here, we've suffered through here. But what I can't understand is why we can't get better candidates for governor. Mary Burke was not a strong candidate. And this gentleman, I don't know much about him, but I understand that he's being accused of looking at pornography and on a school. Well, I mean, really, we can't get better candidates.
Actually, Jeremy, it's not Tony Evers who was accused of that. It was a teacher, and Tony Evers was the superintendent of public instruction. So it was not the candidate who was viewing pornography.
Seriously, I mean, the guy doesn't, the little that I've seen of him, he just doesn't strike me as being a very compelling figure.
And thanks for that, Jeremy. Let's go now to Brendan in Madison. Hi, Brendan.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What would you like to say?
Yeah, so I'm kind of a centrist myself. I'll swing back and forth to both sides depending on the candidate, try to get the facts from both sides. And I'm kind of skeptical of Walker myself, mostly because he's been in office so long. I think politicians get content when they're in offices too long and they're not willing to change as much. But my main concern with Tony Evers is I don't know if he's going to be charismatic enough to be able to carry the areas outside of the solid blue cities in Wisconsin. He's going to have to be able to convince people in northern, traditionally red areas that he's the better candidate than Walker. And I don't know if he can do that.
Thanks for that call, Brendan. And since we're on the same topic, let's bring Lydia from Milwaukee on. Hi, Lydia.
Hi. I'm from Milwaukee. I actually just graduated from Rufus Kane High School, and I wanted to talk about the importance of getting a new governor in office that's not Scott Walker, because any governor might be able to do better than Scott Walker in handling education and handling the education cuts that we've seen in public schooling, especially in the ignorance that Scott Walker and the rest of the Republicans that hold office sort of just ignore Milwaukee and see it as a problem, even though it's one of the economic forces driving the state's economy, as well as his continual cuts with the UW system, while the UW system provides a very important role in not only the education for everyone across the state, but resources and a place to work. And I would just like to see a candidate in office other than Scott Walker. And since Tony Evers was so focused on education, hopefully he can replace, he can repair what damage that Walker has done.
Thanks for that call, Lydia. So a range of ideas there, Lily. Some people saying, you know, Tony Evers just doesn't seem like he's kind of got that charisma to bring new voters over to that side. Lydia saying, you know, kind of doesn't matter anyone but Walker. What are we going to be seeing as far as messaging and reaching out to the voters as we inch towards November?
Well, I mean, again, I think that this is, you're going to have a challenger in Evers who's going to try to define Walker and the issues that, you know, that a lot of people are critical of with regard to Walker. And particularly from the Democratic view, it's the questions around education, as Lydia was highlighting. And then you're going to have Walker, who's going to have to run at least somewhat on his record. And so he's going to be advocating for what he has done in terms of some of the education changes and cuts with regard to, you know, some of the transportation issues and, of course, discussions about the economy in Wisconsin.
There's been talk of waves. There was a Republican wave, a red wave in 2016. There's been talk of whether 2018 is a year for a blue wave. Let's bring on John in Pewaukee next. Hi, John.
Hello.
What would you like to share?
Well, like I said, I mentioned the person before, I'm a moderate independent and I'm Hispanic. And I split my vote in the last election. And I don't see a red wave or a blue wave as much as I see a purple wave. Because when I talk to my friends who are independents and or even Hispanics, I will not be surprised if both Walker and Tammy Baldwin win. Hmm. Because at least with as an independent, I see a lot of friends who are saying, you know, like with Walker, they don't necessarily hate. They don't hate him. They don't say they like him. They think it's okay. He really hasn't made us mad, really. I mean, I know the Democrats are mad at him, but as far as independents, he's okay.
So
and
John,
the same with Baldwin.
So John, as an independent, you really, it sounds like, vote on issues and the positions of different candidates and their party affiliation really isn't as big a deal.
No, I like I said, I'd vote for the individual. I was not surprised when Trump won. I was not surprised. I knew more Hispanics who planned to vote for him than what the press was telling me.
And we'll leave it there. We're getting a little short on time, John, but thanks for that call. And Lily, you know, those independents, that's someone to keep in mind since it's a partisan primary, so we probably didn't get a good sense of them.
Yeah, I mean, and so you have to make a choice. People yesterday had to make choices of all kinds, not only on the candidates, but also the party that they were going to sort of vote for people within. And you know, ballots had five or six different parties that you could choose. And so now we move into the general election when Walker and Evers and Vukmir and Baldwin and everybody else are going to be not only trying to galvanize their base voters, you know, the Republicans or the Democratic voters who they want to, you know, make sure they come and vote, but also to get crossover voters, to get independents like John, or to get ticket splitters, people who, you know, might go both ways, as it were. And so I think we'll probably see messaging of both those kinds as we move into the general election.
And Lily, very, very briefly, turnout was 22.2%, the highest level since 2002. Does that bode well for lots of voters getting to the polls in November?
It's likely to, because primaries don't usually draw as much as the general election. So this may be a blueprint for getting more people to the polls in November.
Well, Lily, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on today.
Lily Gorin is a professor of political science at Carroll University. We talked with her about the results from yesterday's primary elections. Now, Wisconsin is home to over 15,000 lakes covering nearly 1 million acres, some smaller than hockey field size, others miles wide. A quick drive by most of these lakes would leave you looking at many cottages that tend to crop up with them. It seems clear that summertime has many Wisconsinites flocking to the water's edge. Joining us now is a guest who has fallen in love with the rhythms and simplicity of cottage life over the years. Anne Goodwin has enjoyed visiting a 1920s cottage on Pleasant Lake in southeastern Wisconsin for over 30 years. Her new book is called Come to the Lake, Reflections on a Cottage Life. Anne, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Judith.
When did you first realize that lake life is really something special?
I think it was as a child when I attended camp up in the North Woods of Wisconsin and found that my true center in life is in the middle of a canoe or in a kayak paddling.
So you grew up in a place where that was not probably part of your everyday life. You went to camp and all of a sudden this kind of revelation.
Exactly. I found that I'm a true freshwater lake girl.
So that was as a child. And then, if I remember correctly, what you thought was a summer fling had something to do with it as well.
Yes, absolutely. I was fortunate enough to meet a man who brought me to his family's lake cottage in southern Wisconsin. And the minute I walked into the cottage and smelled the old cottage smell and saw the old town canvas canoe on the shoreline and we got in it, I realized I had found something and someone pretty special.
I was going to say, the two went together and it turned out not to be a fling unless 30 plus years is a fling, right?
Right. It was my most miserable attempt of a fling.
A fling fail, perhaps.
Yes.
Well, in your book, Come to the Lake, there are three places that you really show us: the shelter, the cottage next door, and Hilltop. Let's start with the shelter. Tell us about that cottage.
The shelter is how I was introduced to Pleasant Lake. It's a 1920s authentic Wisconsin lake cottage. It has windows that hook up and one-ply boards, and we close it in the fall and open it up in the spring. And the cottage next door was actually my husband's uncle cottage that was built in the late 40s. And it ended up that my brother and I bought my husband's uncle's cottage. So I'm married and I'm also neighbors with my husband.
So these two cottages were in your husband's family.
Yes.
And now kind of a generation later, they're in two families. Is it kind of a fluid experience of who's where and where people are hanging out and where people are eating and where people are sleeping?
Absolutely. It's very communal. There's a well-worn path that goes between the cottage next door and the shelter, and it's simply a family gathering spot.
Again, if I remember correctly, I think there was a point where the house next door or the cottage next door was in some other hands it was not a good situation. And it was very symbolic and meaningful when I think your mother-in-law put up a barrier on that little path.
She did. The cottage next door was actually stolen from my husband's family by an embezzler. And when that happened, my mother-in-law, who was in her 80s at the time, simply put a sawhorse on the path in between the two cottages, reflecting that they were not connected anymore.
But they are now.
They are.
And the Hilltop. What's the Hilltop?
Hilltop is a funny little story of a shack that ended up being put on our property by Matthew's uncle. He sort of drug it over the lake in the middle of winter from as a sample cabin at the time, and he filled it sort of like a hardware store. If you needed something and you couldn't find it at Ace Hardware, you could find it at Uncle Johnny's. And when my brother and I bought the cottage next door, Hilltop at that time was a shed, and it was so full of miter saws, if there was one, there was four. It took four people 3 days to empty it. And for years, it stayed empty. It housed our boats and our grills and whatnots. And then a couple of years ago, we decided it was really a special space. And we turned it into a studio, a creative studio.
Mm-hmm. And that idea of, it sounds like it was kind of a cross between a hardware store and a junkyard. The idea of having all those materials there really made me think about the fact that when you bought the cottage next door, instead of tearing it down and starting from scratch or making a lot of big changes to it, you really decided to repair what was there and really enhance what was already there. Why was that the way you went, and what did it mean to you?
Well, we're cottage people, and that is a lifestyle that's really fading on our lake shores. So many people want to be on the lake full time, understandably. Taxes are high, the season is short, and so these cottages are being torn down and replaced by lake homes. We truly like the analog life of cottage living. It's very simple, and it's something that started Matthew's family with his parents, and back then, Catherine Goodwin said there will be no TV here. And to this day, we really try to live simply there.
I think it's interesting that there does seem to be a difference between having a lake cottage and a lakeside home, and the home being the year round. That's, you know, that's kind of where everything is happening. But it does seem, it's kind of like not wanting to have your favorite food every single day because then it's not as special. Is there something more special about going to the cottage because you can only go part of the year?
Part of the year, absolutely. It's a very precious time. And as I said, it's a short season. But it's also creating a routine of breaking routines. For us, it's simply different than living in our home, which isn't that far away, but it's a world away.
We're talking with Ann Goodwin right now. She has been enjoying a 1920s cottage on Pleasant Lake in southeastern Wisconsin for over 30 years, and she's the author of a new memoir called Come to the Lake, Reflections on Cottage Life. It does seem that there's something about kind of the rhythms of cottage life that really draw you in, and it seems like kind of nourish you and the people that come there. What are some of those rhythms and rituals and traditions?
Well, in the morning, we wake up, and most mornings, my husband will look at me and say, do you want to go for a paddle? And we'll start the day paddling around the lake. It's a wonderful way to experience nature, to relate with each other. It's all about connecting, and our ability to first disconnect allows us to connect at the lake. And it's so feels like a fleeting time in today's world. Everything's so frenetic, and it really is a way that we choose to play together. Our mealtimes are different. They're very communal. I love to feed people. Whatever we're doing at the lake has its own unique flavor.
And what about the people that you're interacting with? Because I think one of the things that stood out to me is that this is, it seems more often than not, a multi-generational gathering. And I think we as a society have really gotten away from that.
Yes, for our family as well as our neighbors' families. So everyone who has grown up on the lake, which I was not fortunate enough to do, now have children who have grown up together as cousins or friends and families. And the lake is some place to come back to. We have four children, and when they walk down that hill, they're coming back to a tradition that's well set in time.
And do you, it's hard to tell what's going to happen with future generations, but just as your generation has, you know, kind of taken over and become the constant, do you see that passing through to future generations?
Hopeful in that regard, but I think that's basically the reason why I wrote the book. It's a personal legacy. It has universal appeal because it provides a respite to the lake. But for me, I wanted to get down on record what our traditions are there and how important they are and how long lasting they have been, because it's more and more difficult with our days of hotspots and laptops and what we can bring to the lake now to protect that special lake quality life. I wanted a record of it.
Has there been any pushback from the younger generations in saying, you know, nope, we're not going to have Wi-Fi, and nope, you know, screen time is limited to whatever a day or none at all? That's a real change from everyday life for them.
Absolutely. And through the generations with our children, it was leave the Game Boy up on top of the car. Now with all of the other devices that have built to be so addictive and so time consuming, it's harder with our grandchildren to enforce Grandma Kao's rules. And I'm getting to be the bad guy, but but it absolutely breaks my heart when I see these devices overtaking our lake time. So I'm pretty strongly voiced when it comes to that.
Grandma Kao, who you just mentioned, figures prominently in the book. Tell us about her.
Grandma Kao was my mother-in-law, and she was the original true Pleasant Lake girl. And she was a woman of many talents and loved all the rhythms of lake life and had five children in this little lake cottage that she always had one in tow to teach a life skill. She built her own fireplace. She reeved canvas canoes. She was a naturalist. She was one of the first just to have a natural shoreline on the lake while other people built cement walls. So she was a true inspiration to me.
So it feels like her presence is still so much there.
Absolutely. I am doing my best to channel her.
We're talking with Ann Goodwin. She's the author of a new memoir called Come to the Lake, Reflections on a Cottage Life. And we want to hear from you about your cottage memories at 800-642-1234. If you've either owned or visited a cottage, what makes the time by the lake so special? What are your favorite ways to spend time there? And what are your cottage life traditions? Do you, like Ann, enjoy the quiet activities, or do you prefer maybe racing around on a jet ski or going tubing? And did you keep a cottage journal? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation here in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're talking with Anne Goodwin. She's the author of the new book, Come to the Lake, Reflections on a Cottage Life. And she's sharing her own cottage memories and reflections. And we want to hear yours as well at 800-642-1234. Do you have a cottage or have memories of visiting one? What traditions did you practice? And what has stayed with you the most? Did you do any journaling of your time there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Stuart did just that. He posted on Facebook, "We went to one that my grandparents rented for a week each summer in Indiana. Nice swimming beach with other kids to play with, where I'd be in the water most of the day getting suntanned, if not burned. We'd spend a lot of time in the evening playing canasta or Scrabble, doing crossword puzzles, listening to the radio, including a shortwave, no TV. Sometimes at night, I'd be given a dollar to walk to the bar grill down the shoreline to buy a Snickers bar and play a few pinball games before heading home to bed early." Stuart, thanks so much for sharing that. And that sounds pretty idyllic to me.
It does. And those board games and charades and all of the activities when we used to participate with each other analogically, if that's a word.
Yes. Yeah. Let's go to the phones. And Jay in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Jay.
Hey, thanks for taking the call. It's a special day. It's a happy day and a sad day. My son, after 30 years of taking him every weekend and teaching him the world of cottage lifestyle. And it was truly a cottage, something I built, a very simple on a small lake in Forest County. Today is the day he's moving into the cottage.
Oh, wow.
So it's a happy day and it's a sad day. So because now I'm going to go visit him in his cottage that he's living in.
Wow, so this is a cottage that was in your family, and now it's moving on to the next generation.
Yeah, he's moving in, and today's the day. He took a job that he starts on Monday, and so it was enough of an attraction that he wanted to be there, and that's what he aspired to do, and today's the day.
Wow, well, Jay, thank you so much for sharing that, and I have to guess that it might have been a little surprising to you to turn on the radio and hear us talking about cottage life. And Anne, that's got to be meaningful for you.
Yes, because I'm so happy, Jay, to hear the end of your story. I thought the sad part was going to be that you just tore down the cottage today, so I'm very happy to hear
it. Or sold it outside of the family. Yeah, well, Jay, thanks so much for that call. Let's go back to the phones and hear from Liz in Madison. Hi, Liz.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, hi, Anne. I'm sorry I missed your name.
Judith.
I'm just calling from Madison, Wisconsin. I grew up in Lake Geneva, and I was sharing my life at the lake. Our family, three kids, we lived on the lake, and we happened to have a root beer stand, and so we made our money as a family in the summer. So we couldn't go to the lake when all the tourists were. So at 11 at night, when the restaurant closed, we'd go to the lake and swim by the moonlight.
Wow.
And in the winter, we'd go to the lake and skate our hearts out. So the lake life and small town living is a part of my upbringing. But I've had the privilege and the pleasure to be at Anne's and to take part of her meals and have the quiet time and to unplug, because I'm as plugged probably as they come. And my dog, Charlie, who idolizes Anne.
Oh.
She has taught him how to waterboard and how to kayak. And if you're at the lake, you do lake things. And
we'll leave it there, Liz. Anne, you've got a fan.
Yes, I guess so. Thank you, Liz.
And it's interesting because you are so connected and your family is so connected to these cottages, but clearly you share that with others. And what is that like? Because there's both the opportunity to be able to share with people who aren't there all the time, but do you ever feel like, you know, it's something kind of special that you want to maybe protect a little bit?
It's our great pleasure to share the lake. It's such a special place to be. And we are hosts who do love to share it. And then there are moments when it's time just to be and not be hosting.
Let's go back to the phones, and Mark in Three Lakes is up. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
I was born in Milwaukee. Parents bought in Three Lakes in 1953. I was born in 1957, giving away my age. I went to school in Greenfield and spent my summers up here on my parents' land on the lake. And since then, let's see, it's umpteen years now, I have moved over 30 years ago full-time up here and having fun since.
Thanks for that, Mark. And actually, Anne, if I remember correctly, that kind of happened in your family too, where it changed from an occasional place to go to a place that you spend a lot of time.
Yes. Since it is so close to my hometown, I'm 42 minutes away from the lake, although a world away, I literally would just pack up the kids at the end of the school year and base from the lake during the summer. So I'm a summer resident at the lake.
I remember you writing about Grandma Kayo and she being one of the women who were there with their kids. Often the dads would come on the weekends, but then they would have to go back for the work week. And those ladies had kind of their own society and culture there.
Without a car.
Wow.
And because the car went back to work. So how they fed five children, maybe with one trip to the store for the week, it amazes me. But she did a grand job of it.
Well, and she was a little different. I mean, the other ladies, not to paint them with a broad brush, but a lot of them were out there suntanning and, you know, kind of the lady of leisure. And like you said, she was out there building things and fixing things and collecting medicinals and all kinds of really interesting things.
Very project oriented.
Let's go back to the phones at 800-642-1234. And Judy in Reedstown is up. Hi, Judy.
Hello. I'd like to know if your Pleasant Lake is the Pleasant Lake that's near Coloma, Wisconsin. It's the Pleasant Lake I grew up on, and I'm still in touch with the kids that I've known for almost 70 years because of our summer spent there. It was a lucky thing that happened in our lives and a wonderful and enduring set of memories.
Is that your Pleasant Lake?
No, Wisconsin's fortunate enough to have more than one Pleasant Lake.
Well, there you go. But it sounds like Judy had, you know, not the same experience because it was a different Pleasant Lake, but the same type of experience. Thanks for that call, Judy. Let's go now to Sally, who's calling from Ludington, Michigan. Hi, Sally.
Hi there. Yes, I am visiting Ludington today, just kind of preparing for the gathering of our family the second week in September. Our children grew up with their summer vacations at a small inland lake near Ludington, Michigan, at their grandparents' cottage. And this year, and we do not gather as a family. Our children, two of our children live on the West Coast, have access to the gorgeous Cascade Mountains and the Pacific Ocean. But when we ask, where would you like to get together, they wanted to go back to Ludington, Michigan. And I have the same kinds of experiences at a little lake that they had as kids.
So, Sally, you said you're preparing for that gathering right now?
Yes. Well, sort of. We came up for a couple of days just to check it out, make sure the town, we can still find our way around, and that the ice cream store is still there, and just things like that. We were at a small inland lake. But almost every day we would drive into Lake Michigan, and the kids called that the Big Beach.
The Big Beach. Well, so many stories, Anne. I mean, does this surprise you at all that lake cottage life has been such a big part of so many people's experiences?
I'm happy to hear them. Actually, I get a little teary as I'm listening about the gathering in Ludington. It sounds wonderful.
So when you head back to your cottage, Anne, either today or soon, what will you be doing?
Well, I will be doing some more radio interviews, actually, and trying and hoping that the Girl Scout camps aren't singing too loud as background noise.
Well, Anne, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your memories.
Thank you for having me.
That was Anne Goodwin. She's the author of the new book, Come to the Lake, Reflections on a Cottage Life. She joined us to talk about cottage memories as we enter this final stretch of summer.